They should hate us so, right? We haven't done it to America. America's, but you can state 30 or 40 things very quickly about what American democracy, quote unquote, has done to us. And we were just trying to live for the faith, huh? Died in every war, right? And yet anybody who came here 10 minutes later was accepted.
Civil rights legend C.T. Vivian. I interviewed him in 2015 in Selma, Alabama. Reverend Vivian died on Friday at the age of 95, his funeral scheduled for Thursday at Providence Baptist Church in Atlanta. Out of respect for Reverend Vivian, the Lewis family says they'll wait till after his services to announce their plans for Congressmember Lewis's memorial. To see the full interviews, democracynow.org, I'm Amy Goodman.
To KBOO Portland.
And at KBOO Portland, it is 8 a.m. on a Monday morning. Time for more talk radio with your hosts, Cecil and Celeste. Stay tuned on your community connection, KBOO. Take it. Cecil and Celeste, you're on.
Thank you, Sonia. Good morning, everyone. Good morning. You are listening to your community connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the metro area, 91.9 if you're in the east along the Columbia River Gorge. If you're in the Willamette River Valley, it's 104.3. And if you're in, let's pick a city, Kalamazoo, Michigan, or anywhere else, it's www.kboo.portland. Good morning. Hope you're enjoying the sunshine, rising of a new day. How are you, Cecil?
I am well. I'm wondering, have you memorized that? Can you just blurt it out where we are in your sleep, or does it come automatic?
Yeah, it's pretty much memorized by now. You know, unless I have a hungry mouth.
Sorry.
When my mouth refuses to behave. But other than that, yeah. You know, that's one of the blessings of having done this for so long. Everybody who has supported KBOO and may even be motivated to support KBOO right now, because it's given me the opportunity to not only learn and memorize it, but to share with the community. So thank you, everyone, for supporting KBOO. So I was listening to Democracy Now!, and I've been checking out the news all weekend, and I thought before we hit the show, we wanted to acknowledge that the blessing that comes from the air means that we're standing on the shoulders of giants, real giants. And if you were listening to Democracy Now, you know that we are talking about C.T. Vivian. And who is the other giant, Cecil?
John Lewis.
Absolutely.
I was, you know, it's been a really surreal time weekend for me. On Friday, first hearing about the death of C.T. Vivian, and that sort of reminded me of oh no, there's another one who struggled for us and who had passed away. And I came across a picture of C.T. Vivian. This was later on that day after I heard John Lewis had died. I came across a picture of C.T. Vivian, John Lowry, Andy Young, and John Lewis, taken when they were older, and it must have been at some ceremony where they were honored. And you people may recall that in this past spring and this summer, we lost first Reverend Joseph Lowry, who became the head of Southern Christian Leadership Conference following the death and of Abernathy, who succeeded MLK. Reverend Lowry led the SCLC in much of the 70s and 80s and 90s, and leading on and advancing the struggle for civil and human rights. He died this past spring. And then there was the death on Friday of C.T. Vivian and John Lewis. And of those four people who were in that picture, I saw Andy Young, who was a aide to M.L. King and later congressperson from Atlanta. Andy Young is the last one of those who died. And I speculated that those four people imbued by their lives the best of our country. And I said, you know, what suppose if on this stone mountain in Georgia, that where it is etched Confederate generals, what if we somehow erase those traitors to the principles and ideals of our country and replace them with John Lewis, Joseph Lowry, C.T. Vivian, and Andy Young. I think those four persons I just named symbolize the hopes and dreams of all of us much more than the traitors who are on the edge on Stone Mountain. But I was just speculating. And I'm kind of like kind of weary, not weary, but kind of tired this morning, because I think I stayed up very late watching the live stream from the from downtown Portland last night, where for yet another night freedom strugglers were resisting the federal troops and Portland police, and again we saw an incident again of federal troops and Portland police attacking the persons who were downtown exercising what is guaranteed, the freedom of speech and freedom of assembly. And I thought of those freedom fighters today and how they are, I think, continuing the legacy of people such as C.T. Vivian and John Lewis, who I term John Lewis as a compassionate revolutionary. And I thought that, and we'll hear lots of these professional pundits and mainstream politicians today and in the days ahead try to sanitize the life of the revolutionary life and vision of people such as John Lewis. And I think it's helpful for us to remember what I think is his true character and lifelong commitment to justice. And I was privileged to actually meet John Lewis introduce him at a rally here in Portland a few years ago at yet another anti-war rally, and he consented to speak to those of us who were gathered in downtown Portland. So that's something I will remember by this man who continued throughout his life to be a compassionate revolutionary for justice and peace. So I thought it's helpful for us not to hear the words or listen as the final words what mainstream politicians say of people such as John Lewis, and remember the young revolutionary who defied the established civil rights leaders to attempt to mute him at the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. And, you know, the elders said that, you know, not your speech is too revolutionary. You have to change your words. And, you know, at that rally, a 23-year-old Lewis proclaimed, "I appeal to all of you to get into this great revolution that is sweeping this nation. Get in and stay in the streets of every city, every village and hamlet of this nation until true freedom comes, until the revolution of 1776 is complete." And in 2018, a 78-year-old Lewis, 55 years later, looked out and said to those who are continuing the struggle for freedom and justice, he said, "Do not get lost in a sea of despair. Be hopeful. Be optimistic. Our struggle is not the struggle of a day, a week, a month, or a year. It is the struggle of a lifetime. Never, ever be afraid to make some noise and get in good trouble, necessary trouble." And as I heard, that was Congressman Lewis. And as I heard one of the people express their frustration last night as the cops were attacking them and saying that he was tired and he was angry and almost apologizing for being angry, I messaged him and said, you know, you don't have to apologize for being angry. Be encouraged and know that this is a long struggle. And I think hearing the words of John Lewis near the end of his life and his continued struggle and optimism and determination, I think, is something that should inspire those of us who are continuing that legacy for freedom and justice.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. And, you know, I think it's really important to remember that this is a long struggle. It's a lifetime struggle. And to put it in context for folks, and one reason why we have to stay diligent and vigilant and, you know, on the task, on the job, so to speak, is that for Black Americans, this is the year 2020, and it's been, oh, I don't know, 400 years worth of struggle. And that calls for a ongoing mindset of push forward, use, at this point, I would say almost any means necessary But remember, this is a marathon. This is not a sprint. But anyway, you know, as we launch into our topics for today, I also want to note something, because if you were listening to Democracy Now!, you heard how John, I think it was John Lewis, was saying how when President Johnson said that they will overcome, you know, one of the organizers had said, "Why have you not sent the troops down here to protect us? Because you will send troops over to fight in, you know, these foreign wars." And Johnson was pretty much kind of shamed and brought to task, and he sent the federal troops down there to protect these people who only wanted the right to vote. That's what they were looking for, to get registered and vote. And now we're looking at the troops come down and attack people who want to protest that things are not fair, you know. And for the most part, people are trying to use the nonviolent tactics that you heard both C.T. Vivian and John Lewis's spouse, for the most part. And so I think it's ironic how things have turned, how we are in a new season of life here in this country, where not only is the nonviolent protest not respected, but the rule of law is not respected either. You know, we have a president who doesn't care. You can't say doesn't get it, you know, because, excuse me, we don't really know if he's marching to somebody else's mandate or this is his mandate, and really it doesn't matter. What we do know is this is a person who has demonstrated time and time again that they do not have a value for the everyday person's life. And I'm sure there'll be some people who might want to argue with me, but I think a good example to illustrate this is an article by John Blake from CNN from Friday, July 17th. Is entitled "Why White Supremacy is Actually Killing White People," and it's not like this is new. I mean, white supremacy has killed white people pretty much since it was instituted, because you have to remember that this country was not founded for the ordinary white person. You were expected to be landed. You were expected to be educated. You were expected to have the social and educational currency to actually participate in the government, you know, and the government of the people, by the people. Ordinary people couldn't vote. That's why you found a lot of white people feeling disenfranchised, because they're thinking, hey, wait a minute, I'm white, how come I don't count? Well, you're of the uneducated, unlanded, unwashed masses, and that's what it was. And so when you read this article by John Blake, he speaks with W. Camus Bell, and he also is speaking with Damon Young, who is from he's an author and a television producer who he's part of one of the articles, Two Very Smart Brothers, and you can find that in the Root news article or newspaper,
a blog.
Yeah, thank you. Words fail me, Monday mouth. And I find this to be a really interesting article. And then you contrast that one with this other article that we wanted to offer. And that is the fact that there is a quote-unquote real white supremacy. And how Ross Douthat from New York Times says, or he asked, does the white upper class feel exhausted and oppressed by meritocracy? So these are interesting points to kind of ponder today as, you know, we're watching the world kind of burn as Trump fiddles, and we're trying to figure out new ways of making things like nonviolent action, you know, make a big difference, make the difference that we're supposed to. So what did you think of the article?
Yeah, I think it's the article by Mr. Blake. I had a chance to glance at it, and it talks about I'll tell you one thing that I think challenging about this article and many of the writings we see is, I think it has a tendency to center white people.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand the raise the issues in terms of white supremacy and how it impacts white people. But I think part of the challenge, just generally, is we need to decenter white people. It isn't, and I think we need to acknowledge, the voices of others and to center those who are oppressed, just generally. Having said that, I think it's an appropriate article, and it's truthful in terms of, I think, indeed, in terms of how oppression and people such as John Lewis and T.T. Vivian articulated the idea that oppression impact negatively those who are the oppressors as well as those who are oppressed. And until we get to that point where we recognize that and find our common humanity, we will continue to descend down this hole of destruction. Yeah, so those are my initial thoughts about that. I haven't had a chance to really look at the other article you mentioned yet. I'll try to do so and do my homework before the teacher calls upon me again.
Oh, you're listening to Board Talk Radio here on Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. I'm Celeste Carey. I'm here with my co-host, Cecil Prescott. And we are talking about two articles that we kind of shared and how they kind of weave into the backdrop, which had not occurred when I picked these articles. When I picked these articles, it was early last week, and so John Lewis and C.T. Vivian had yet to pass. And so that kind of cast these things in a different light, in a sense. But the articles, Why White Supremacy is Actually Killing White People by John Blake in CNN, and then The Real White Fragility, which is in the New York Times, and that was, let's see, what date is come out, July 6th? Oh, no, 18th, by Russ. And, you know, I probably should know how to pronounce his last name. I'm going to say Delphit. They both kind of express why this is a non-viable, invalid response to the question, you know, Rodney King asked, can we just get along? When Damon Young was interviewed for the article, Why White Supremacy is Killing White People, he looked at how the non-landed, non-educated, non-socially prominent white people are suffering just as badly as a lot of folks of color, because white supremacy does not value white lives. White supremacy has always mattered more than white lives actually do. What do you mean, Celeste, when you say that? Well, according to Damon Young, white supremacy is what is killing people because, for example, racism put Donald Trump into office. Trump has ignored the pandemic protocols that were left behind by the Obama administration, and that has put American lives at risk. White supremacy has put Donald Trump on a head-to-head dynamic with China, and that has caused a lot of white Americans in middle America to find themselves suffering because their job can't get the necessary materials to work, or they can't get the goods to work, or perhaps there's something else going on where their goods won't be bought, so they are suffering. White supremacy is what kept us from having a good response to some of the other natural disasters that have occurred in the country, where Trump took his time responding to the ordinary people in the area. One is not having clean water in parts of Michigan, Detroit. You know, one is not making sure that there are adequate funds for COVID testing. So, you know, you look at this and you think, how can you not see that this is a invalid response to wanting to have a life that the Constitution has held so dear and has held so high? You know, you look at this and you think, okay, it's not just affecting folks of color. White people are dying too. Join us, talk about some strategies, how you see this. You know, how are you addressing this whole idea of the white supremacy dynamic, especially, you know, when you talk to your family and your friends and show them that this was not a viable solution for anyone, and that you have to change course. It's not just about black people wanting to vote. It's not just about brown people wanting to live in the United States. It's not just about all folks of color wanting an equal opportunity just to be a human being. It's about not killing yourselves, or as our grandmothers used to say, don't cut off your nose to spite your face. Phone number is 503-231-8187. And yeah, we're taking calls, and let's talk a little bit also about the other article, The Real White Fragility, here while we wait for people to wake up and get to the telephone. What do you think about this whole idea of white supremacy killing white people?
Is that the question for me or for our listeners?
No, that's for you. That's for you while we wait for people to call in. What do you think?
And we want people to address this question as well.
Yes, we do.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure so people say, okay, what am I supposed to speak about?
I thought you were trying to get out of the teacher having called on you.
No.
Okay.
No, I wasn't. I just want some clarity and for
yeah.
those who are calling. So I've been speaking so long. So what is it that about what white supremacy?
What do you think about this whole idea that white supremacy is killing white people?
Well, I think just by the nature of what it is in terms of domination and in terms of how it impacts. So any domination theory, and one can look at it in many cultures and throughout history, in which a domination theory is manifested and is pushed by a dominant class of people, which tend by its very nature to be a very small group, as a way to control and to continue to have power. And as we have seen it, as it has been manifested in the United States, I'm speaking of in terms of how the dominant power maintained control in the by using white supremacy, and how it has, as you suggested, benefited a small group of people by allowing a larger group of people to somehow identify with the smaller group in power, so that this larger group of people can do the bidding of the smaller group, and this white working class oppressing people of color, black indigenous people of color, and doing the bidding. And we see this manifested, you know, over and over again, and has been examined in terms of sociologists and organizers who say, how come you are working against your own interests? The challenge is to find ways in which those who are oppressed can recognize their common oppressors and find ways of organizing together. And the dominant class will continue to keep people apart from one another and use one against the other. And we've seen attempts in throughout the United States history of alliances of cross-cultural, cross-racial coming together. You know, we've talked about this several times on this program, looking at, for example, particularly organizers in the South who try to organize poor whites and black people, many of them communists, and also in the north. So how do we build unity? That's a challenge that continues.
Well, I think we have a caller.
We do.
Did I hear?
I believe Barry is on the line. Go ahead, Barry, you're live.
Yeah, Cecil, how are you?
I'm
well.
How
are you doing?
Good morning.
Good. One thing mentioned was the book Across That Bridge in Amy Goodman's interview with
yes.
John Lewis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and it came out, I don't know if it's still available, but it came out in 2012. And that's the same year that another book came out, Solving 9/11. That's by Christopher Boland. I wonder if anyone is aware of that, or have they gotten any?
I'm not aware of that book. I'm aware of the book, John Lewis' book.
Across the Bridge. Yeah. Well, this was making his decision to become a part of our workings, our I don't what do you call it? Pardon me?
No, go ahead, Barry.
Uh-huh. Oh yeah, okay. This was his decision to become a part of our structure as Joanne Hardesty, now Commissioner Hardesty, has decided to become a part of our structure and work on the inside, and I thought that was a good analogy between the two. But
oh,
But 2012, solving 9/11, it's a terrible thing that came about. 2,300 deaths and all that stuff, and it seems to be forgotten. Yet, whoever brought this on seemed to want to create that war on terror, and that the war on terror is causing so much disruption in the Middle East and everything, and the deaths and the refugees everywhere.
Right. Yeah,
yes,
well,
to
get together, Barry, with Congressman Lewis in the Amy Goodman conversation she had that was aired before our program. She talked to the congressman about his vote and to give President Bush the authority to conduct warfare after September 11th. And he said that in that interview.
Good point.
You know, he regretted it. He wished he would have joined the Congresswoman from California, Barbara Lee, in opposing that. And that I think it's a recognition how we can, if we can go down a path we're not totally in line with, if we veered off of our principles. I think that Congressman Lewis recognized, as I think we all ought to, as I think you might be suggesting in part, is that we have to be aware of the war machine and how it continues to run amok, and we need to try to be consistent to stand and oppose it. So Wes, any thoughts?
Oh, yes.
Well, I was going to suggest that part of the challenge is recognizing that you said this earlier, getting inside of the machinery to try to make a change from the inside. And we have to recognize that there has to be both dynamics. Because if you merely stand on the outside and shake your fist at the machine, you don't get very far.
Yeah.
But when you can get in and talk to the people, it makes a big difference. And unfortunately, war machinery is totally against the whole concept of nonviolence. And so we have to remember.
Absolutely. You're right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but thank you for your call. That's a little off topic for us, but I do appreciate you reminding us that we have to be aware and stay diligent and vigilant on all sides, because this whole idea of oppression is fueled and funded by war. But thank you for your call.
And you are listening to KBOO, your community radio station. Our numbers here to join us on More Talk Radios are 503-231-8187. I am Cecil. I am here with Celeste. And we await your call. Celeste, you know, one thing, I don't want to get off topic, but one thing you mentioned earlier was, you know, in terms of resistance and how we do it. And I just want us to make ourselves very clear. I want to be very clear, to be aware of how language is used. So oftentimes, one is that those who resist the systems are seen by the system as troublemakers. And I want to remind John Lewis that, you know, get involved in good trouble, become troublemakers. Bayard Rustin once said that we want some angelic troublemakers.
Yeah.
And so we need to continue to hold that true, and also to recognize the language. So oftentimes you'll hear the media and those in power talk about peaceful demonstrators. Well, there's a difference between, this isn't what we're talking about. I don't want peaceful demonstrators. And when you talk about nonviolent resistance, it's resisting a machine. And if you do so, you put yourself in harm's way. And as Mr. Lewis and countless other women and men and girls and boys throughout history, if you resist the machine nonviolently, you'll be looked at as a troublemaker, you'll be beaten, you'll be jailed. And so I want to commend those who are resistors. And, you know, we don't have much that we can oppose the machine, but our bodies and our lives and our commitments.
So I'm gonna call on you now. So what is the difference in your mind between nonviolent and peaceful protest? Is there a difference? How do we define it? Because you bring up a very important point, is that even if you stand on your porch and you raise your fist and you say Black Lives Matter, you can still be mischaracterized as a felon and beat up and arrested. So for clarity's sake, like you said, how do we differentiate? Is there a difference between a peaceful protest and a nonviolent resistance or protest?
Okay. And I'm, you know, I'm literally a card-carrying pacifist.
Wait a minute. Say that again. You're what kind of pacifist?
Card-carrying. You remember that?
Oh, gotcha. Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
Official, yeah. I have a card for
you. Got a card,
for the Fellowship of Reconciliation and all of that. Mm-hmm. But I think what we try to say is the important words together is nonviolent resistance.
Mm-hmm.
You are resisting the system. That's the noun. The adjective is nonviolent. Peaceful demonstrators, I think it depends on who's saying it. And for those who are powerful, I sense mm-hmm. they're saying that you'll be quiet and go home as we allow the oppression to continue. If you are a resistor, how shall you resist? I think, and we've had people on our show talk about it, that an effective way to resist is nonviolently, and that by nonviolent is by using your body, your life, your principles to block, to prevent, to stop things from operating. And you can do this philosophically or you can do it tactically. Tactically, as I think people who are on the streets downtown in Portland, they do not have the warfare, the tools to resist what the feds are doing down there. So they are by being who they are nonviolent resistors because they are unable to resist effectively. You know, throwing a stone is not the same as some of the weapons that the feds have. So nonviolent resisting is using the tactic of your body, your life, your principle, your wisdom, and there are many tactics, you know, boycotts, letter writing, marches. Those are all ways in which you can be a nonviolent resistor. But the key thing is resist. And it means you're going to get in trouble.
Okay, I can work with that.
Okay.
So we want some more discussion. I know it's Monday. I know people are trying to wake up and figure out what they're going to do today with the normal that we live in. I'm not going to call it the new normal because it hasn't settled down yet. So we live in the constant changing. That's what I call it. But give us a call, 503-231-8187.
Ralph
here
is on the line.
More Talk Radio. What was that again, please? Do we have another caller?
Yeah, we've got Ralph. Go ahead, Ralph. You're live.
Go ahead, Ralph.
Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning. I have an idea I would like your thoughts on. It's somewhat related to your topic, so I hope I'm not diverting the show any. But I live in a mostly white community. My neighbors and I, we have a lot of Black Lives Matter signs up all over the neighborhood, which is great, wonderful to see. But I see that as only a small step in real change. Real change for me would be having people of color as my neighbors, as my coworkers. And so here's my half-baked idea. Let me fly this by you. Neighborhoods in the city would get a tax break if they can verify that people of color are changing the percentage of home membership. Of home ownership, you know, because we use taxes as incentives to donate to charity. You buy a house, you get a mortgage, you get a tax break. So why not use these tax breaks as a way to incentivize people who may be a little reluctant to integrate to do so? Now, I know this gets into affirmative action and how do you identify people of color and all that stuff. And I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a politician. I really don't know how to discern all that. But it seems like it could be a step towards real change. And real change is what we need, not just, you know, wearing the T-shirts and posting the signs.
Nice. Wow.
Well, that's an interesting concept, but you know, one of the things that I could see as a possible barrier is that the tax break is a micro move for the neighborhood, whereas one of the barriers that exists is a macro barrier in the fact that banks don't want to loan money to folks of color. And it doesn't matter whether you are Latino, whether you are Black, whether you are Asian, whether you are Native American or whatever, they don't want to loan money. And if they do, it's a subprime loan at a higher and basically predatory interest rate. So the people who would loan the money don't see any motivation to loan it. And the people who live in the neighborhood that would get the tax break don't have any input in making the banks loan the money. So we have to, I mean, it's a good idea in that it serves to create a community, but the problem is the system in which that community operates. You know, the banking system and all of that is a barrier, and we got to figure out how to break that barrier.
But couldn't this help exert pressure on the system if people's interest is to increase home ownership by people of color? Then it would be one small step to bending the bank's will to make those loans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it's something go ahead, Cecil.
No, I think, like Celeste, I think it's a interesting ideas to explore. And you know, we've seen, you mentioned caller, you know, it might lead to question around affirmative action, and we've seen how in terms of business communities have sought to make it an incentive for people to invest and to hire workers. And maybe, you know, the greatest thing that get people moving is make it economically personal. Profitable. So, you know, tax incentives have been a way in which they've created things like enterprise zones and stuff like that. So why not in terms of home ownership?
Well, you know, one way you could start that is maybe to get your community interested by petitioning some of the banks who make a big deal of talking about how they unlock doors and how they provide opportunity to do this and go out and kind of like stump for this. You know, go to them as a community group and say, hey, we hear you want to do this, that, and the other. We've seen your ads on TV. How about you do this? And that's what, something that could start as a grassroots effort and perhaps grow into an effective community campaign to get banks to recognize that people in the community really do care about having a diverse environment. You should give it a shot.
Okay, I'll have to get an education as a banker to tackle that, but maybe not.
You know, all you would have to do is get in touch with the members of your community and get people excited and go talk to the banks about what would it take to get you behind this, and then release your efforts to the media. Make sure that, you know, some of the mainstream media knows that you're trying to do this so that you can get a little publicity. Maybe even you can go through your neighborhood association and see if you can get some of those members on board, because, you know, diverse neighborhoods have shown to be really strong and economically stable neighborhoods. So, hey, you could give it a shot.
Okay. All right. I'll take that as an encouragement.
Yes,
all right.
Indeed.
Thank you. Hey, and thank you so much for calling. And, you know, I think it's encouraging for people often say, well, what can I do? Or I'm powerless. And just as our caller suggested, sometimes you're doing something and an idea occurs to you and you share it with one another and who knows where it goes. So I
That's
think,
true.
Again, you know, you asked earlier about what are some ways in which one could be nonviolent resistors. I mean, there's a way in which you can petition and advocate for open and fair housing in your community. Yeah, always different ways in which to resist.
We have Bill on the line.
Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. I wanted to comment on protest, and it's fascinating to me how we forget that at one point in time, while Martin Luther King is now celebrated, at one point his peaceful protest still in some people's mind presented a great danger to America.
Oh,
while
yeah.
While contrasting that with Malcolm X, I do believe that if there was not what they deemed, or the Black Panthers, if there was not what they deemed a, I guess, potentially violent group compared to Martin Luther King, Martin Luther King's movement and others may not have been as successful, because no one has ever peacefully given away power.
You're right.
So that's no different than, to me, saying peacefully protest is no different than saying let them eat cake. It's an oxymoron, and I'm not one who believes that ultimately you are correct. The force that protesters face, there is no way they can fight that in its most violent manner. So I don't believe that violence ultimately is the way to achieve peace. Those are all temporary gains, in my opinion. But without the extremes, we do not know what works when we are fighting a system that has the ability and the economic power to morph itself into anything it needs to be to prevent change from happening.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Very much so.
I totally agree. And we have to change our strategy. Go ahead, Cecil.
I was just going to say your initial observation about MLK, I think it's helpful for us to remember that in 1966, two-thirds of Americans held an unfavorable view of Martin Luther King. Since that time, he's become Saint Martin, but, you know, he was hated while he lived.
Yes.
I would like to share one more thing, if I could. As a man of color, I am often fascinated by the fact that the images that we are presented with respect to, I guess someone you could say is a leader in the black community, is usually only after they have passed. Never are they elevated while they are living, in my opinion. And it's almost like we are always given dead leaders to celebrate rather than celebrating them while they are here and while they can make the biggest difference in this world. With that said, you two have a great day as usual.
Well, thank you for your call.
Thank you. I wonder why do we find it easier to celebrate those after they die? Is it because they no longer have power and they are
and don't have agency over their age, their image?
Safer dead than alive. I don't know.
Well, I think that might be part of it, and I think also the fact that they no longer have power and agency over how they're perceived. You know, you can't be the boss of you anymore because you're God. But I think it's something that I'm going to have to paraphrase out of the Christian Bible, which basically says, you know, a prophet has absolutely no respect or renown in his hometown. So maybe we don't like the fact that as a live person, this being is trying to exemplify some high ideas and high moral standards. Maybe that's something that only dead people are supposed to achieve.
Right.
I don't know. I'm just guessing. It's 8:55. We have time for maybe one more call. Is there one, Sonia?
Not at the moment.
Okay, then. Well, we didn't really get a chance to get too much into the other article I wanted to talk about, which has to do with raising a new generation, I guess, of elites and how they come to realize that meritocracy is maybe a mirage. You know, because of the way society has been structured, and that this particular meritocracy that they've been pursuing all this time only has a room for a few. And so maybe as they recognize that this new body of elites, this next wave of elites, are being fragile, according to some folks' ideas, because they've realized that there is a certain dynamic energy that this fake meritocracy has, and that in itself it's a dead pursuit because it has no energy, because it's a worship of perfectionism or emphasis on certain other things, like maybe, you know, delayed gratification or what have you. But we'll try to weave that into another day, and try to also maybe get them posted.
Okay.
For yourself, yeah.
Well, let me end our show again with words from John Lewis. Words that I think we can all reflect on and respond to. He said, "Do not get lost in a sea of despair. Be hopeful, be optimistic. Our struggle is not the struggle of a day, a week, a month, or a year. It is the struggle of a lifetime. never, ever be afraid of making some noise and get in good trouble, necessary trouble.
Necessary trouble. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, KBOO listeners, get into some necessary trouble today and join hands with your neighbors, regardless of race, creed, color, gender, what have you, because we're all human beings on this planet, and this planet needs all of us together to survive. This is your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the Old Mo Variety Hour. We'll catch you next week.
KBOO Portland.